A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
A Finnish conscript on skis at minus 40 degrees Celsius, rifle slung, moving silently through birch forest in the dark. A U.S. Marine in full body armor in 55 degree Iraqi heat, sweat soaking through every layer before the morning patrol even starts. Two ends of the same problem. How do you make a human being at a rifle function when the environment is actively trying to kill you?
The strange thing is, most military training happens in what you'd call nice weather. But the battles that reshape maps, they happen at the edges of what's survivable. Napoleon in Russia, Stalingrad, the Chosin Reservoir, Fallujah in July. The environment isn't the enemy, it's the multiplier that makes every other enemy worse.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what actually happens to soldiers and their equipment when the thermometer hits either extreme, and how some militaries, especially the Nordic ones, have figured out how to fight in conditions that would kill the unprepared in hours. There's a lot to unpack here.
It's more urgent now than it was during the Cold War, which sounds counterintuitive. The Cold War was all about the fold a gap, wasn't it? But the Arctic is remilitarizing fast. Russia reopened something like 50 Soviet-era bases above 70 degrees north latitude in the last few years. NATO ran Exercise Cold Response in Norway with 20,000 troops. And at the same time, climate change is expanding desert warfare zones and making heat exposure worse in places where militaries already train and fight.
Where do we even start? The body, I assume. That's the platform everything else depends on.
So the human operating window is narrow. Core temperature at 37 degrees Celsius, give or take 1 degree. Outside that band, things degrade fast. Heat stress triggers vasodilation. Blood vessels near the skin widen to dump heat. And sweating kicks in up to 2 liters per hour in extreme conditions. But once core temperature crosses 40 degrees, you're in heat stroke territory. Proteins denature, the blood-brain barrier starts breaking down, organs fail. It's not a gradual slope, it's a cliff.
The cold side?
Vasoconstriction. Blood pulls back to the core to protect vital organs. Shivering kicks in, which can increase heat production fivefold, but it burns through energy reserves fast. Below 35 degrees core temperature, you're hypothermic. Cognitive function drops, motor control goes, and somewhere around 28 degrees, the heart becomes electrically unstable.
Both ends of the thermometer are essentially a countdown clock. But what's interesting to me is that the failure modes are different. Heat kills you by cooking your brain. Cold kills you by shutting down the periphery and then the core.
Both degrade combat performance long before they kill you. The U.S. Army's Natick Soldier Research Center, this is the lab that studies human performance under stress. They've quantified this. At 40 degrees wet bulb globe temperature, which is a measure that combines heat, humidity, and solar radiation, marksmanship accuracy drops 30%. Tactical decision-making speed drops 40%. That's not soldiers are uncomfortable. That's soldiers can't do the job.
Wet bulb globe temperature. Define that quickly, because it's going to come up again.
It's the gold standard for heat stress measurement. Unlike regular temperature, it accounts for humidity, wind, and radiant heat from the sun. A dry 40 degrees is brutal but survivable with water. A wet bulb 40 degrees, high humidity, no breeze, direct sun. That's the threshold where even a healthy person sitting in the shade will overheat. The U.S. military uses it to set work rest cycles and flag conditions.
40 degrees wet bulb is the point where the body's cooling systems just fail to keep up, regardless of fitness.
Sweat stops evaporating, which means it stops cooling. And on the cold side, the cognitive degradation is different but just as severe. At minus 20 degrees Celsius, fine motor skills, reloading a rifle, operating a radio, applying a tourniquet, degrade within 15 minutes of removing gloves. After that, you're fumbling. And in a firefight, 15 minutes is an eternity.
Which brings us to the equipment. Because the body is one problem, but the tools are a whole other category of failure.
This is where the physics gets stubborn. Let's start with heat. Lithium-ion batteries. They're in everything now. radios, night vision, drones, GPS units. Above 50 degrees Celsius ambient temperature, they lose 20 to 50% of their capacity. That's not a gradual degradation. That's your drone going from 30 minutes of loiter time to 15, or your night vision cutting out mid-patrol. And in a desert summer, 50 degrees ambient is a normal afternoon.
It's not just batteries. Polymer rifle stocks warp. Optics fog internally. And once fog forms inside a sealed scope, you're done. There's no field fix. The M4 carbine's direct impingement gas system, which vents hot gas directly into the bolt carrier, overheats faster in desert sand and dust. That was actually one of the drivers behind the Army's shift to the SIG MCX Spear, the XM7, which uses a short-stroke gas piston that runs cooler and cleaner.
Right. Adopted in 2022. But the cold side has its own specific nightmares. Lubricants thicken. Standard mil, spec LSA grease becomes paste at minus 40 degrees. Rubber seals crack, and metal becomes brittle. During World War II, the German MG-42 machine gun had a documented 1 in 500 receiver fracture rate below minus 30 degrees Celsius. That's a catastrophic failure. The receiver is the core of the weapon. It's not supposed to break, ever.
1 in 500. So in a battalion with, say, 100 machine guns, you're statistically looking at a receiver failure every 5 engagements in deep cold. That's a terrifying failure mode. Your squad's primary suppression weapon just...
Modern equipment isn't immune. Drone batteries lose 50% capacity at minus 20 degrees. That 30-minute loiter time becomes 15 minutes, same as in extreme heat, but for completely different electrochemical reasons. In cold, the electrolyte viscosity increases and ion mobility drops. In heat, you get accelerated degradation of the electrodes. Same outcome, different mechanism, no universal fix.
Why can't we just ruggedize everything? That seems like the obvious answer. Build it tougher.
Because ruggedization runs into fundamental physics limits. You can't change the chemistry of lithium-ion electrolytes to work optimally at both minus 40 and plus 50. You can't make a lubricant that stays thin at minus 50 without it becoming uselessly runny at plus 50. You can't make a polymer that stays flexible in Arctic cold without it getting soft in desert heat. The best you can do is shift the window, optimize for one extreme, and accept degraded performance at the other.
Which is exactly what the Finns did with the RK-62 rifle. And this is where the contrast between design philosophies gets really stark.
The RK-62 is a masterclass in designing for cold from day one. Oversized trigger guard, big enough for a mitten, not just a gloved finger. The bolt handle is shaped so you can operate it with a full Arctic mitten. The stock is made from a polymer blend that doesn't crack at minus 50. Compare that to the American M16A4, which had a 1.5-inch trigger guard and required bare fingers to manipulate the magazine release. In minus 40, you're choosing between frostbite and being unable to reload.
That's not an engineering oversight. It's a doctrinal difference. The US designed for Vietnam and temperate Europe. The Finns designed for the only thing they've ever had to worry about, a Russian armored column coming through the winter forest.
It shows in the details. The RK-62's sights are set low and wide, designed to be used while wearing a fur hat or helmet liner. The safety selector is a large paddle that clicks audibly. You can feel and hear it through 3 layers of clothing. These aren't expensive features, they're choices. And they're choices that most militaries don't make because they don't train for sustained operations below minus 30.
Let's talk about vehicles, because the same pattern applies. You mentioned the British Challenger 2 in Iraq.
Iraq 2003. The Challenger 2 is a phenomenal main battle tank in European conditions, but in 55 degree ambient heat, the air conditioning systems failed. Not degraded, failed. Crews had to operate with hatches open just to avoid heatstroke, which negated the NBC protection, nuclear, biological, chemical, that the tank is designed to provide. And even with hatches open, crews reported that 6-hour shifts had to be cut to 2 hours before heat exhaustion set in. That's a 70% reduction in combat effectiveness, and it's purely environmental.
The flip side, the Norwegian CV-90 armored vehicle. What makes it different?
The CV-90 has a cold start system that preheats the engine block to minus 40 degrees Celsius before ignition. This sounds simple, but it's actually rare. Most NATO vehicles have cold start procedures that involve external heaters, long warm-up times, or just accepting that you're going to wear out engines faster. The Norwegians integrated the preheater into the vehicle itself, so it can start instantly in conditions where other armored vehicles are effectively immobilized for 20 to 30 minutes.
A 30-minute startup delay in an ambush scenario is not just inconvenient, it's fatal. So the Norwegian approach is to treat cold not as an edge case, but as the default operating condition. And that philosophy extends beyond vehicles.
That's the right segue into the Nordic doctrine piece, because equipment is only half the picture. The other half is training, and this is where Sweden, Norway, Finland, and Denmark have built something that most other militaries don't even attempt.
Conscription helps, right? When every citizen cycles through military training, winter warfare isn't a specialization, it's baseline.
The Swedish Armed Forces Winter Unit Certification requires 4 continuous weeks of field training below minus 20 degrees Celsius. Not a weekend course, not a PowerPoint and a practical exercise. 4 weeks of living, moving, and fighting in deep cold. And the training covers things that sound basic but aren't. How to layer clothing so you don't sweat and then freeze. How to set up a shelter that won't collapse under snow load. How to cook and hydrate when your water bottle is a block of ice.
The layering point is worth dwelling on, because there's a widespread misconception that cold weather gear is just thicker clothing. And that's exactly wrong.
It's completely wrong. The principle is moisture management. Your base layer needs to wick sweat away from your skin. That's wool or synthetic, never cotton. Cotton absorbs moisture and holds it, and wet cotton has essentially zero insulating value. That's where the saying cotton kills comes from. It's not hyperbole. The mid-layer provides insulation, fleece or down. The outer layer blocks wind and sheds water. If any layer fails at its job, the whole system fails. And you need to be able to add or remove layers as your activity level changes, because sweating in Arctic conditions is genuinely dangerous. The moisture freezes when you stop moving.
It's not about warmth. It's about managing the microclimate next to your skin. And the Nordic militaries have turned this into a science. I've read that Swedish winter rations provide 4,500 kilocalories per day versus the standard 3,500.
Because cold weather operations burn through energy at an astonishing rate. Shivering alone can increase metabolic rate fivefold. Moving through deep snow on skis or snowshoes is exhausting, and you need more fat in the diet. The body uses it for both insulation and slow burn energy. Swedish field rations in winter include things like butter, cheese, and high-fat sausages that would be considered unhealthy in garrison but are essential in the field.
Which brings us to the Finns and the Mali tactic. This is one of those rare cases where a specific tactical innovation completely upended a larger, better-equipped force.
The Winter War, 1939 to 1940. The Soviet Union invaded Finland with overwhelming numerical superiority, something like 3-1 in manpower, far more in tanks and artillery. The conventional prediction was that Finland would fall in weeks. Instead, Finnish ski troops used the terrain, dense forests, frozen lakes, deep snow, to isolate and encircle Soviet mechanized columns. They'd cut the column into segments by felling trees across roads, then attack each segment from multiple directions. The Soviets were roadbound because their vehicles couldn't move through deep snow. The Finns, on skis, could move 3 times faster than a soldier on foot and strike from any direction.
A soldier on skis in deep snow moves 3 times faster than on foot. That's a force multiplier that doesn't show up in any equipment spreadsheet. It's purely about training and doctrine.
It's still Finnish doctrine today. They've updated the equipment. Modern snowmobiles, all-terrain vehicles, but the principle is the same. Use mobility and terrain knowledge to defeat a larger, less agile force, and the modern equivalent extends to armored units. The Norwegian Panserbataljonen, the armored battalion, conducts live fire exercises at minus 30 degrees with full chemical protection. That's a standard that most NATO units only achieve in temperate conditions. Their secret is partly cultural. They just don't see cold as an excuse, but also practical. Every vehicle has a built-in warm-up shelter tent that attaches to the rear hatch. Crews can rest without exiting the vehicle, staying in a heated microenvironment while remaining combat ready.
That's the kind of detail that sounds small until you think about the alternative. A crew huddled outside in minus 30, burning calories and losing dexterity, unable to remount quickly if contact happens. The tent is a force preservation tool.
It's the kind of thing that gets cut when a military treats cold weather capability as a nice-to-have rather than a core requirement, which is most militaries.
Let's flip to the heat side. Because the Nordic model is instructive for cold, but the desert presents its own unique challenges, and some militaries have gotten very good at managing those too.
The Israeli Defense Forces have been dealing with armored warfare in desert heat since their founding. One of their innovations is cooling vests using phase change materials, PCMs. These are substances that absorb heat when they melt, and they're engineered to melt at around 28 degrees Celsius, just below skin temperature. A tank crew member wears the vest under their body armor, and as their body heat rises, the PCM absorbs it, keeping their core temperature down for several hours. It's passive. No batteries, no pumps, no moving parts.
Which is exactly what you want in a combat environment. No logistics chain for coolant. No electrical draw on the vehicle.
The Australian Army has taken a different approach with what they call the stealth suit, developed in 2024. It uses radiative cooling fabric that reflects 90% of solar radiation while still allowing sweat evaporation. The physics is clever. The fabric is engineered to emit infrared radiation in a specific wavelength that passes through the atmosphere without being absorbed, effectively radiating body heat into space. It's the same principle that lets desert surfaces cool rapidly at night, but apply to a wearable fabric.
It's not blocking heat. It's actively dumping it. That's a fundamentally different approach than just wearing lighter clothing.
It points to the direction that material science is going. But there's also a lower-tech solution that's proven remarkably effective. Prehydration protocols. The U.S. Marine Corps runs a course at 29 Palms, California, called Fighting in Built-Up Areas in Heat, FIBU, AH. 2 weeks of room-clearing drills in 50-degree body armor. Heat casualties used to be a major problem. In 2023, they introduced a mandatory prehydration protocol, 1 liter of water with electrolyte mix, 2 hours before training. Heat casualties dropped 60%. 60% from something as simple as drinking the right fluids at the right time.
That's astonishing. And it suggests that a lot of heat casualties aren't from the environment being unsurvivable. They're from soldiers starting the mission already dehydrated.
Which is a training and discipline problem, not an equipment problem. And that connects back to the Nordic model. The difference between a unit that's acclimatized and one that's not is enormous. Full heat acclimatization takes about 2 weeks of daily exposure. Cold acclimatization takes closer to 4 weeks. The physiological changes are real. Increased plasma volume, earlier onset of sweating, lower salt concentration in sweat for heat, improved peripheral circulation and metabolic heat production for cold.
The human is the weakest link, but also the most adaptable part of the system. You can't acclimatize a lithium-ion battery. You can't train a rifle stock not to crack. But a soldier who's been living in the environment for 2 weeks performs dramatically better than one who just stepped off a plane.
This is where the U.S. Army's heat cap program gets interesting. It started in 2021. Wearable sensors that monitor heart rate, skin temperature, and sweat rate to predict heat stroke risk about 30 minutes before symptoms appear. The algorithm looks for patterns that precede collapse, a specific heart rate trajectory combined with rising core temperature and dropping sweat rate. Before HeatCat, commanders relied on the wet bulb globe temperature flag system and subjective assessment. Now they get an objective warning.
30 minutes of warning before heatstroke. In a combat situation, that's enough time to pull someone off the line, get them into shade, start cooling. It turns heat casualties from an acute emergency into a preventable event.
It's the kind of thing that would have been science fiction 20 years ago. But it also highlights a tension that runs through this whole topic, the tension between specialization and versatility. The U.S. Army's Extended Cold Weather Clothing System, ECWCS Gen 3, works from minus 50 to plus 10 degrees Celsius. That's impressive. But soldiers in Afghanistan at 40 plus degrees had to strip down to undershirts. There is no single uniform system that works across the full range, because insulation and breathability are physically opposed. You can't trap heat and dump heat with the same garment.
That's the core of the unsolved problem. How do you design a soldier and a rifle for both minus 50 and plus 50? The honest answer is, you don't. You design modular systems that can be reconfigured by theater, clothing layers that can be added or removed, vehicle kits, Arctic, and desert. That can be swapped at the depot. Rations that are formulated for the expected environment. And you accept that a unit optimized for Norway will need time to adapt before deploying to the Sahel.
That modularity is expensive and logistically complex. And most militaries, even large ones, can't afford to maintain completely separate equipment streams for every climate. So they compromise. And the compromise is usually biased toward temperate conditions, because that's where most training happens, and where most procurement decisions are made.
Which is a choice that has consequences. Napoleon's Grande Armée lost roughly 400,000 soldiers to cold during the 1812 Russian campaign. That's not combat losses, that's environmental attrition. On the Eastern Front in World War II, frostbite casualties exceeded combat casualties in some units. And on the heat side, British Army data from Iraq between 2003 and 2009 shows that heat illness was the second most common non-battle injury, second only to, actually, I don't know what was first, but the point stands.
Musculoskeletal injuries were first, sprains, strains, stress fractures, but heat illness being number two in a modern military with air-conditioned bases and abundant water tells you how brutal the environment still is. And climate change is making this more urgent, not less. The U.S. Army's 2024 Arctic Strategy explicitly acknowledges that melting ice will open new conflict zones, the Northern Sea Route, resource extraction areas, contested maritime boundaries. At the same time, the same document warns that 30% of current U.S. training bases will face dangerous heat levels by 2040.
The military is simultaneously planning for more Arctic conflict and more heat stress at home. That's a planning nightmare.
It's a forcing function for exactly the kind of modular, adaptable systems we've been talking about, and it's why the Nordic model matters beyond Scandinavia. The Finns, Swedes, and Norwegians have demonstrated that cold weather capability isn't an accident of geography, it's an investment. They chose to build conscription systems that train every soldier in winter warfare. They chose to design equipment for the worst-case scenario. They chose to write doctrine that treats snow and ice as terrain to exploit, not obstacles to endure.
The results speak for themselves. A Finnish conscript on skis, at minus 40, with an RK-62 that works because it was designed to work in that exact environment. A Norwegian tank crew in a CV-90 that starts instantly because the preheater is integrated, not bolted on as an afterthought. These are choices, not gifts.
What does all this mean for the future of warfare?
First, there is no universal solution. A force optimized for Arctic warfare will struggle in deserts, and vice versa. The answer isn't a magic fabric or a wonder battery. It's modularity. Clothing systems, vehicle kits, rations, and training protocols that can be swapped by theater. The U.S. Army's Soldier as a System initiative is moving in this direction, but it's early days.
Second, the human is the weakest link, but also the most adaptable. Training and acclimatization can improve performance by 50% or more. The Nordic model of year-round outdoor training is more effective than episodic cold weather courses, because adaptation isn't something you can cram. It's a physiological process that takes weeks. And the prehydration protocol at 29 palms proves that low-tech interventions, consistently applied, can outperform high-tech solutions.
Third, climate change is forcing a rethink. The Arctic is remilitarizing while desert warfare zones expand. The next generation of equipment has to handle a wider range than ever before, and the side that masters its environment first will have a decisive advantage, the way Finland did in 1939. The question isn't whether extreme environment warfare matters, it's whether your military is building for it now, or will be caught building for it after the shooting starts.
There's an open question that I keep coming back to. As autonomous systems take on more logistics roles, drones, robotic mules, unmanned resupply convoys, does the human thermal envelope become less relevant? If a robot mule can carry ammunition through 50-degree heat without breaking a sweat, do we still need soldiers who can do the same?
I think the answer is yes, but for a reason that's easy to miss. Autonomous systems fail. Batteries die, sensors ice over, comms links get jammed. When that happens, the human has to take over. And if the human can't function in the environment, the mission fails, or worse. The human is the fallback, the redundancy, the thing that works when everything else doesn't. And that means the human has to be able to work in the environment, full stop.
The human as the ultimate backup system. I like that. And it means that all the investments in cold weather and heat weather capability aren't just about today's fights. They're insurance for a future where the autonomous systems we're counting on might not be there when we need them.
Next time you see a soldier in full kit, remember that every piece of gear is a compromise between minus 50 and plus 50 degrees Celsius. And that compromise might be the difference between a mission accomplished and a casualty report.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
For decades, food historians attributed the discovery of vanillin, the primary compound in vanilla, to a French chemist in the 1850s. In fact, the compound was first isolated in the 1920s by a German researcher aboard a research vessel crossing the Drake Passage, who noticed the aroma while analyzing lignin samples extracted from Antarctic driftwood. The finding went unnoticed for years because the journal it was published in ceased operations during the Weimar hyperinflation, and the correct attribution was only restored in the 1990s.
Right. Right. This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtob. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps new listeners find the show. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.